This is Ozarks at Large. Cities regularly come up with and update their various master plans for transportation, sustainability, trails, roads, the list goes on. But Anthony Townsend, who is an internationally recognized expert and author on urbanization and digital technology, says it's time for cities to begin thinking about creating digital master plans. Townsend was on the University of Arkansas campus Wednesday, and he spoke about smart cities as part of the Research and Innovation Speaker Series. While in town, he stopped by the KUAF studios for a conversation with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. Townsend began the conversation by explaining just what a smart city is.
The term first emerged maybe 20 years ago. Bill Mitchell, who is the dean of the architecture school at MIT, coined it. And he was really trying to talk about cities that use digital technology to organize services, the way buildings work, the way transportation systems work in more efficient ways, so that machines like cars and trains that might be unoccupied or idle could be put to better use by coordinating them with computers, basically. It was an idea that people had thought about for a long time, but it was finally possible. And I think the easiest way to understand what smart cities means to the everyday person is to look at the apps on your phone. What are the apps that you use to either summon or control things around you that aren't next to you? So you use Uber or Lyft to call a ride. You may use Nest or something like that to control the thermostat on your home. Those are all services that use technology, use software, use sensors, use telecommunications to pull things together, to tie them together, to make the city work better.
And tied into smart cities is the practice of digital master planning. Some cities have already taken this on. What is a digital master plan? What does that mean and what does it do?
So one of the things that's challenging cities right now is that these technologies are arriving in a kind of haphazard way. Companies are rolling out products. People are buying them, and there's really no rhyme or reason to where they're popping up. It's one of the reasons why services like Uber have caused so much confusion and conflict. And if you look back, say, 100 years ago, when electric power was built out into cities, telephone networks were built out into cities, the automobile arrived, it was sort of the same thing. Private industry arrived with this great new technology. They wanted to build it out at urban scale. And we had to figure out how those two things fit together, how you weave the new into the old. And digital master planning is really an emerging practice in a lot of cities to think about that systematically and to think about it long term. So, you know, where should we put broadband? Where do we need to subsidize it to make sure that everyone gets connected? What kinds of sensors does the city need? Do we need to track air pollution or traffic? Is the private sector going to cover the city the way we need it covered so that we make sure we understand everything that's going on? These are really big new issues that cities need to tackle, and they don't have the process for doing that with the way they think about the future currently.
And some cities, some much bigger cities, like New York City and Chicago and San Francisco, have started approaching this with actual plans in place. What did you find by looking at those plans?
So in a lot of ways, digital master planning is kind of where sustainability planning was about 10 or 15 years ago. In the early 2000s, a lot of big cities around the world realized that they needed to take the lead on climate change. And so they started to think about, you know, over the long term, what are all the things we need to do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? None of them had any idea how to do it, because it had never been done before. They didn't know who to talk to make the plans. They didn't know what to put in the plans, and they didn't know how to implement them. But they sort of made it up as they went along, and they learned from each other. And eventually they started to converge on a kind of standard methodology. Again, 100 years ago, this was the same thing with transportation planning. And now every city from Mexico City to Mumbai to Memphis, transportation planning is done the same way. So that's sort of where digital master planning, I think, is headed. Now, what we haven't seen, as happened with sustainability plans, is that eventually a law gets passed that says we have to do this. And even when the mayor who did the first plan leaves office, the next mayor has to do one. Whether we'll see that with digital master plans remains to be seen. But if we do, that'll be a really powerful signal that these technologies are an important part of running cities and making them better in the future.
So why are these digital master plans important? Why should they matter to cities?
Yeah, I think the big risk is that if government, the public sector, with lots of citizen participation, doesn't set the agenda, that the industry will. And I think if we've learned anything about the innovation system that has produced the internet in the last year, it's that it's not representative. It doesn't build in the kinds of safeguards for vulnerable people that we need in our technologies and our networks. And other voices have to be heard and other priorities have to rule. And I think that's why the public sector needs to lead and say, look, you know, we want the smart city to be an inclusive place. We want it to be a fair place, not just an efficient place, and not just a place that changes quickly, because, you know, quick change isn't always good for everybody.
So are cities playing catch up at all just to get to the point where some of these technology companies are with these innovations?
You know, I think we're at a really interesting point right now. In Toronto, Google is trying to build a smart urban district on the waterfront through its city building arm, a new company called Sidewalk Labs. And there's a lot of, you know, fanfare with the announcement. And in the 2 years since, the community has mobilized to ask a lot of very difficult questions. They have got the ears of their elected officials who are now asking very, very hard questions about whether this is in their long-term interest to allow a big tech company, a foreign tech company, to come in and essentially take over big parts of their city. And not just running the city, but actually setting the agenda for the city. And so I think this is one of many turning points that we're going through right now. Something similar happened in New York City, rejecting Amazon's bid to build a headquarters there. We're still sort of sorting through the rubble of that event. But I think what's clear is that Amazon's labor practices were something that a lot of people felt like had not received sufficient scrutiny, and that they didn't want that city becoming, you know, a pillar of the community unless there was a much more open, honest dialogue about their behavior.
So what about digital master plans in smaller cities like Fayetteville, let's say? Most people don't live in New York or Chicago or San Francisco. A lot of people do live in cities, but they're much smaller. So how does digital master planning look in a smaller city?
I mean, I think a smaller city like Fayetteville has a lot of opportunities because you kind of have the best of both worlds. You have access to this global technology that, you know, is available everywhere now. The same computers and the same telecommunications network and the same software. You know, you can have it shipped overnight the same way that I can have it shipped overnight in Manhattan. But you also have a rich social fabric of people who see each other face to face every day. So finding ways to weave those two assets together to get the best of both, I think, is the real opportunity and the real challenge. And it's really thinking about what are the biggest problems that you have? And then the technology is flexible enough that it can be crafted to create solutions for whatever those problems are. I think it's making sure you don't lose focus on what your real problems are rather than becoming, you know, kind of seduced by solutions that may not apply.
So obviously digital master plans haven't been around for very long. A lot of cities have just had them for a few years. But what makes a plan like that successful?
The most successful digital master plans are ones that engage a pretty broad range of voices very early in the process, not just of saying what's going to be in the plan, but even saying what topics should be covered. London's plan, for instance, drew upon hundreds, if not thousands, of different organizations from government to the private sector to universities to citizen groups. And then on the back end, those stakeholders all become part of implementing the plan. So you can delegate pieces of the action agenda to those that participated in helping craft it. And I think the thing about digital technology that's different than the civil infrastructure that we built in the past and the services the government provided in the past is that it's so complicated. And government really can't do it alone. It doesn't have the money. It doesn't have the engineering resources. The private sector, the nonprofit sector has to be a part of making this happen. In cities where we've seen these plans just kind of spring fully formed from the mayor's office without a lot of public consultation, there just hasn't been buy-in, and they haven't been carried forward, and they haven't gotten implemented. So I think it's really vital that these be as networked as the technology is itself.
So the public sector needs the private sector to make this all work, but earlier you mentioned that these digital master plans are a way of making sure, in a way, that tech companies aren't setting the agenda in a city. So how does that collaboration, how can that collaboration work?
I think the best way for cities to benefit from tech companies participating in making these plans is to learn from them, but to always be aware that, you know, their companies pushing their agenda. You know, IBM, when I set out to write my book in 2010, was the single biggest advocate of the idea of smart cities. And it was really, you know, a self-serving campaign. They were pulling out of the recession. Their corporate customers weren't spending a lot of money on tech. And they thought cities would be spending stimulus funding on you know, software. And what happened was they didn't sell a lot of software, but they taught a lot of cities about what was possible. And, you know, while I railed against them, I in retrospect, I think they did a good thing by kind of opening the eyes of mayors and city councilors and people all around the world about what was possible.
As technology becomes a bigger and bigger part of our lives, more so than it is even now, what lessons should we be learning from everything we've experienced with technology so far?
Yeah, I think the biggest risk right now is cybersecurity. So for years, I've been saying that we need to have some sort of requirement that anytime you build a big smart city project, you have like the security version of an environmental impact assessment, which is we stop everything and we study all everything that could go wrong for a year. That's what happens when you build a big real estate project now in most states and cities. We need that for security. We found out in the last year that the Russians are in the water system, the Chinese are in the power grid. This is now the new normal, that anything that's connected is corrupted. And at some point, there's going to be a big industrial accident. You know, we'll have a 3 mile island of smart cities. And, you know, I think we'll have a reckoning then about whether the choices that we've made today were good ones or not. But I think, you know, we need some leadership to say that we need to put those firewalls in place now.
You mentioned these technology systems are really big and complicated. And over the last few years with the news stories that come out pretty regularly about a lot of big tech companies, it feels like we're on a sort of learning curve with all these unintended consequences and then maybe some intended ones. Is there anything we can do about that?
I think it takes a really long time for people to connect the dots. We just found out 2 weeks ago that Facebook offers a tool to people advertising housing rentals that allows you to draw a red line to exclude certain areas from searches. This is a well-known technique of denying capital to inner city communities called redlining. It's the reason the Fair Housing Act exists. Bankers used to draw red lines on maps and say, we don't lend to people in this district. And it was usually a way of saying that's a minority district and we don't want to lend to minorities. It was discrimination. Racial discrimination had nothing to do with creditworthiness. It was just bad. The fact that that product made it to the market at Facebook, hundreds, if not thousands of people looked at it, tens of thousands used it. And, you know, it didn't come out in the news for years that it existed. This kind of thing is really baked in to the system of innovation. And I think it's because it's complicated, it's because it's subtle, it's often unintended, and it's just very, very difficult to detect. And I think the people that track these things are kind of tearing their hair out, even just trying to map the space that's in dispute, that they're going to have to monitor for these kinds of harms going forward, because it's just a tremendous, arsenal that the industry is putting into play with AI and data mining and all these things.
So is it just something we're going to have to live with and just accept that that is part of the innovation?
I really think it's an unintended consequence of these technologies. But I think there are ways to push back. I think we need more ethics education in engineering, in business. And we don't do that now. It's more commonplace in Europe, but in the U.S., we don't do it hardly at all. You really shouldn't be able to get an engineering degree without taking an ethics course in the U.S., but most engineers don't get it. You shouldn't be able to get a business degree without an ethics course. But again, most MBAs don't do it. Even most ethics courses in law schools aren't that good. So I think those kinds of things become more important as the technology challenges us, in very subtle ways.
Thank you for taking a moment to stop by in between all the other things you're doing today.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm excited to be here. So thank you.
That was urbanization and digital technology expert and author Anthony Townsend speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek while visiting the University of Arkansas for the Research and Innovation Speaker Series.